Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a look inside the campaign to convince Republican county supervisors to authorize hand counts of ballots after the last election.
And we meet an Arizona farmer who's facing ongoing drought.
But first, all eyes are on the Republican National Convention this week as the GOP officially nominates its ticket, Donald Trump and Ohio Senator J.D. Vance. And Arizona is well represented there. We've heard from Senate candidate Carrie Lake, Jim Chilton, a fifth-generation rancher from southern Arizona, Yuma businessman David Lara, and Sarah Workman, a single mother there, to talk about her struggles living in, quote, Joe Biden's economy. Arizona is one of very few integral swing states in 2024. And we are at the center of some of the biggest issues for the Republican Party this year, immigration and inflation. Well, our own Ben Giles is in Milwaukee this week covering the convention. He joins us now to tell us more about it. Good morning there, Ben. Ben, do we have you on the line? Looks like we have lost the connection with our own Ben Giles. We will return to that conversation when we can get him back on the line. Thanks.
Following the 2022 elections, there were efforts to convince county boards of supervisors to approve hand counts of ballots rather than use ballot counting machines. New text messages obtained by VoteBeat detailed the campaign by some GOP state lawmakers to convince Republican supervisors to take that step, in some cases assuring them that the move was legal, despite differing opinions from the Secretary of State and Attorney General. Jen Fifield of VoteBeat joins me now to talk about her reporting on this. Good morning, Jen. Thank you for being here. So let's talk about where specifically these efforts were focused. It wasn't every county. It seems to have been focused on just a few counties, right?
It was in quite a few, I would say several, and they're mostly targeting, the state lawmakers are targeting people in their own communities, supervisors, who they may have established relationships with. They're mostly conservative counties that might be more willing to look at this issue. So we saw Mojave County, they went to La Paz County, Pinal County, Cochise County. So some of the more rural areas of the state as well.
And what were the arguments that these Republican state lawmakers were using to try to convince county supervisors to do this?
Well, State Senators Sonny Borelli and Wendy Rogers, both Republicans, really emphasized the idea that they felt that it was legal to get rid of voting machines entirely. Just to back up and clarify a few things, in Arizona, we do fill out hand fill out paper ballots that then are scanned by machines. Mm-hmm. And there, it's followed up by a audit of paper ballots that for a select number of them. So there's been ideas to expand that audit to a full audit after the machine count. Whereas Sonny Borelli and Wendy Rogers say, no, just get rid of the machines entirely. We believe that they're switching votes and yet not providing proof of that when they talk about this and asking them to just do a full hand count, which research has shown is a lot less accurate than machines. It takes weeks, maybe even months, as we saw in the Cyber Ninjas audit after
right.
2020. And so, but they're mostly focusing on, we think this is legal.
Well, that, as I mentioned in the intro, differs from the opinions of the Secretary of State and the Attorney General, right?
Right. Our Secretary of State, Adrian Fontes, and our Attorney General, Chris Mays, both do not believe law allows you to entirely get rid of machines or to expand this hand count audit to 100%. The initial count is kind of where the law is a little fuzzy. And now we have a Republican in Mojave County who's actually challenging that and suing Chris Mays and saying, we need to figure this out in court because this is what our constituents want.
So Attorney General Mays got a grand jury to indict a pair of Cochise County supervisors. Did that play into anyone's decision on other boards to maybe say, I hear what you're saying, Republican legislators, but I'm not sure I want to go down that road?
It absolutely did. So at the time this was all being considered in full, the text messages that I have show that this pressure campaign was really taking place last summer, because that's when we planned for how we do elections the upcoming year. It was really focused on, is this legal and what would happen to us if we did this? And so at the time, I had found out eventually that they were investigating the supervisors in Cochise County for trying to expand their hand count audit in 2022. But they hadn't been indicted yet. But Chris Mays was still saying, if you do this, I will, you know, you will be persecuted personally, not just the county. And it is a felony. So be ready for that.
So in terms of the actual text that you looked at, like, what stood out to you from what the Republican legislators were saying and what the Republican county supervisors were saying back?
You know, it really just stood out to me that there were these text messages. So we see, you know, publicly, as I said, Sonny Borelli and Wendy Rogers saying, you know, you need to do this. This isn't legal. But then we see her in Pinal County, specifically with Supervisor Kevin Kavanaugh, text right as the meeting is about to start, or at some point during that day, saying, don't let them lie today. So really texting a personal message to him. In Mojave County, we saw in Cochise County, we saw Senator David Gowen. Who lives in Cochise County, texting as the meeting began again, saying, do you know there's no law preventing this? Those kind of messages. So really just kind of reaching out to people who they had connections with and trying to get the point across.
At this point, does it seem as though any boards or any individual supervisors might still be willing to try this, to at least put it up for a vote and see if they can convince colleagues to go along with this after the 2024 election?
So after the election, yes, I would say definitely the conversations that I had from supervisors in these counties, they have not cut off the issue. What we might also see is not for the initial count of ballots in November, but maybe, you know, if a certain candidate loses and they want to try to confirm that with a full audit of the hand count, or at least expand that hand count audit of how many ballots you're counting and what races you're looking at, that might also be something that they're still interested in doing.
Interesting. All right. That is Jen Fifield of VoteBeat. Jen, thanks as always for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. And there's a much-cited statistic we often hear when we're talking about the Colorado River water and drought in Arizona. Most of it, about 70%, goes to agriculture. And a whole lot of that goes to grow things like alfalfa to feed cattle. It's been the subject of much ire over one Saudi Arabian-owned company that used Arizona water to feed cattle halfway across the globe. So today we're going to hear from one of the local farmers who grows alfalfa here. Nancy Kaywood is the co-owner of Kaywood Farms in Casa Grande. Her grandfather purchased the farm in 1930, and it's been passed down throughout her family since. She told me when she was a kid, they used to watch their well to make sure it didn't get hit by lightning during storms. But in recent years, water has become a much more serious problem.
It's much more of a problem now. It was always dependent on surface water from the Gila River that was routed in canals. So the water comes from Coolidge Dam, and that depends on rain and snowmelt. And it goes to Florence, where it's diverted into canals. So my granddad probably experienced years of drought. We never heard too much about it. In 1993, Coolidge Dam overspilled its spillways, and, you know, everybody thought, oh, man, that's great. We got great water. And then we didn't see the rain and snowpack each year, and the lake level of San Carlos kept going down. And in the early 2000s, we weren't able to plant a lot of crops we normally plant. Our farm was not in full production. Mm-hmm. But by the year 2018, there had been several years we hadn't had cotton in the ground. And by the year 2018, the dam only had 228 acre feet. I went up to take a picture, and floating on the top was just, you know, so many dead fish. It was just solid dead fish.
Wow.
And then by the year 2021, the dam only had 47.5 acre feet, And within just a few weeks, it dried up completely. And then also, we are on an unlined part of the San Carlos system. So they've lined about half of the canals with a concrete lining. But unfortunately, we're still probably 10 miles away from a lining. And so therefore, they don't want to run well water, or if they had CAP water, they didn't want to run it our way, because so much of it would, you know, soak into the soil. So that didn't help either.
So where do you get water today?
Today, we're dependent on the San Carlos Irrigation District. The dam can hold 900,000 acre feet of water, but because of drought, today it only has about 280,000 acre feet. So it's, you know, very, very low.
So talk a little bit about, Nancy, some of the other changes you've seen in that part of the state near Casa Grande in recent years. Like, I'm sure there's been a lot of development, more people moving in. There's also more solar around you.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. You see, we have to pay a water assessment, and it is attached to our taxes. And it's around $19,500 a year. So if we don't have water coming to us, you know, we're still expected to pay this water assessment. So a lot of farmers that are in San Carlos Irrigation District are selling to solar development because they don't want to be strapped down to that assessment anymore. So they sell all or part of their land to solar development. The other thing that's happening is, you know, there's a lot of industry that's coming in around here and also in Phoenix and Tucson. And so Casa Grande is sort of like a bedroom community. You know, they're just building and building and building. We have so many apartments going in, and there's been approval for even more.
Do you often feel pressure to sell your land, Nancy, in that area?
Yes. We have been approached over and over again, mostly by solar. And we do not want to sell. It's been tradition in our family to farm. But the other thing is, my son lives on that farm, and it would be very complicated to have to sell and leave. We don't want to sell. We want to continue farming. That's just kind of in our blood. It's our tradition.
So we know that we are running out of water in the Colorado River, and we hear all the time that agriculture, you know, uses most of that, 70-some percent,
yes,
right? And I wonder what you think when you hear that. Like, do you feel like you're being blamed, or that you have a, you know, a right to that much of the water coming in?
Okay, here's my thoughts on this. First of all, we all have to eat. Now, the other thing I always say is agriculture is freedom, and we need to keep it in our own country. We have a 365-day growing season in parts of Arizona, and we're capable of producing, you know, winter crops. Look at Yuma. They produce winter crops for the whole nation. We depend on our Arizona agriculture to provide food for the nation and for parts of the world. The other thing that I find interesting is people look at the alfalfa, because there's quite a bit of alfalfa grown around here. And they say, oh, those farmers, they waste so much water on alfalfa, it doesn't do me any good. Well, one of my favorite sayings is alfalfa is milk chocolate in the making. Because we feed it to dairy cows, they give us milk, and we can make chocolate from it. But if you were to go into a grocery store and you went in there just to trace your food back to where it came from, you would find that alfalfa is so important. If you're going in, say, just say to the cereal section, it's in your cereals as dry milk. And in the baking section, go into the soup section and you'll find your cream soups. And of course, then there's the meat and the dairy section on top of that. And so it's a very, very important crop. And we can get 8 to 10 cuttings a year to feed animals around here. And if there's an overabundance, it can be shipped to other parts of the country, where they might only get 1 to 3 cuttings. So our alfalfa is very, very important.
So what do you make of the argument that farmers in the Southwest in the future are going to have to, you know, think about things differently, grow less thirsty crops, that alfalfa can be grown in other parts of the country that, you know, have more water?
First of all, alfalfa can't be grown in other parts of the country and get the number of cuttings that we get. No, that's because of our desert climate that we get all of those cuttings. We have looked into alternative crops, but when you do that, you're going to have to purchase new equipment. You're going to have to learn how to grow them. We've looked into olives, but because we have unlined canals, we can't put anything on a drip because our water is so silty.
So I wonder if that's where you think the federal government should step in, right? Like, I know the federal government is paying farmers here and elsewhere to fallow fields to save water from the Colorado River, right? I know you haven't done that. But I wonder, like, do you think that the federal government should invest in family-owned farms like yours to help you transition to less thirsty crops?
Okay, yes, I do. I really feel that the government should help us either. One of the things that we would like to see is for them to help us pay our water assessment. When we cannot farm, we're still having to come up with a water assessment. And if we continue to have to do that, if the drought continues, we would probably eventually be forced to sell out because I don't know how much longer we can hang on. My son does lease land that helps cover water and taxes on this farm. But how long can we keep doing this? So if we could receive some sort of a subsidy from the government, especially in times of drought, so when we cannot grow anything, when everything is fallow, it would help us to be able to hang on. We need to encourage our young people. The average age of the farmer is, I think, 61 years old. And the kids, the young ones coming up, don't want to farm because they see the struggles. I'm very fortunate. I have two grandchildren. And both of them want to continue our farming tradition.
All right. We'll leave it there. Nancy Kaywood, co-owner of Kaywood Farms in Casa Grande. Nancy, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for telling us your story and all about the situation there. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
Offices across Arizona and the country have been undergoing changes, especially since the pandemic, when many workers did their jobs remotely. There have also been a lot of conversations about how to get employees back to the office and what kinds of office spaces they want.
That's kind of the way the office design process works. It's one size misfits all. There's a small group of people making decisions for a large group of people, and they can't possibly anticipate or understand all the different nuances of all the employees.
That's Adam Goodman, CEO of Goodman's, the Phoenix-based office furniture store, as in the company that helps other companies design their offices. Goodman says before the pandemic, 80% of his employees were there in person. Between 2020 and earlier this year, that number dropped to 5%. He wanted to bring more workers back to the office, but he didn't want to force them to. He wanted them to want to come in. So Goodman spent about a year renovating its space, which is a combined office and showroom. But before jumping in, the company enlisted a research firm to interview their employees about what kind of workspaces would incentivize them to come back to the office.
The headline of what they came back was, our people said they want to be able to socialize with their colleagues and they want complete uninterrupted privacy. And those two things are in direct conflict with each other. So we had to workshop, well, what does that mean and how does that look?
One of the things that I find so interesting is the fact that you did this research, given what it is that you all do here. You help offices design their spaces, and yet it seems like you were kind of at a loss to some extent to figure out what to do with your own office.
I wouldn't say we were at a loss. So we did design the entire office using the old paradigm that we've always used, which is essentially, as I look back on it now, it's guessing what our people wanted. And we've done so many offices, we feel like we're pretty good at this. And we came up with an entire plan and then found this research company and started over from the beginning. Well, if you compare those two plans together, they're completely different. The guessing that we were doing was wrong.
In an effort to get it right, at least for his own employees, Goodman says the company decided to design a variety of workspaces and features. Some areas encourage workers to talk and collaborate and even grab a cup of coffee, while others are more heads-down spaces with a quiet library kind of feel. And it seems to have worked. Goodman says since the showroom opened, between 60 and 80% of his employees are in the office on any given day. I met with Goodman earlier this year to take a look at the 20,000-square-foot space, and he started our tour at the front door, which features classic pieces of furniture.
We've got, if you use the music metaphor, we've got trendy pop music all over the space. And I'm a Swiftie, so that's great. I love trendy pop music. But right when you walk in the door, we want to set a tone with classical music, and that's what that's what's going on up here.
Not far from the front is a new kitchen and coffee bar. Goodman thinks of it as bringing the coffee shop you might like to work at into the office.
Our break room used to be hidden in the back, and it was unremarkable. We pulled it to the front. We elevated the design aesthetic. We added an island that's like a kitchen at home. Everyone gathers around the island along with the benches. And now this is the place it's a magnet for drawing people in to connect with each other.
On the day I visited, crews were working to finish an outside patio space where employees could work al fresco, another finding from the interviews. In addition, there are traditional boardrooms, modular meeting rooms, rooms that look like old-school phone booths where workers can take or make a call, and private wellness rooms complete with recliners, puzzles, and other features aimed at helping workers relax. Goodman says having different spaces for different workers at different times is critical.
We believe workers are shoppers and that they want to pick and choose where they do the work based on the tasks they have in front of them or the resources they need or the people they're with. And so all throughout the space, we have a diversity of different kinds of spaces where you can meet.
There's been so much discussion about open office versus cubicles versus offices versus some kind of combination, bullpen, that kind of thing. Are we in a place right now where there's sort of consensus on what the right office environment is, or are we sort of in a place where everyone's just still trying to figure it out?
There's definitely not consensus. And it's a lot to do with the culture of the company coming in and the perspectives of the leader. So no, there's no consensus. I would say, however, whereas the train was moving towards open offices, call it 5 to 10 years ago, in mass, that's reversed course in the sense that now every new facility is a new opportunity to rethink whether you're open, closed, or some sort of mix.
You reference this also being a showroom. I would imagine that having all these different kinds of spaces is also, it's good for your employees, also probably good for business, right? People come in and see the different kinds of things, maybe things they hadn't thought about, spaces they hadn't thought about before, and maybe ask you to, I don't know, do it in their office.
From your lips to God's ears, Mark. That sounds like a fantastic plan. Let's see if we can make that happen.
Was that a consideration when you were putting this together?
Yeah, we had dual audiences we had to serve. Definitely our primary audience was our employees, but at the same time, we got to be aware that we're showcasing what our customers are interested in seeing or ideas that'll challenge our customers.
When the majority, if not all of your employees are back in this building, when you step out of whatever your space looks like, what do you imagine seeing there? And maybe what do you imagine hearing?
As I go east in the building toward the front, a hum, a buzz, laughter, a lot of laughter is what really I'm looking forward to hearing again. My office is close to the west side, so I don't expect to hear a whole lot of laughter, a whole lot of much. This is where we're keeping heads down and keeping it uninterrupted. And also as a walking through, seeing people connecting with each other, spontaneously, just running into each other and having a quick impromptu conversation about something that they may not have had the opportunity to when they're both sitting in their closets at home working remotely.
When you look at the kind of work that you do here, how much of what you do you consider design and how much do you consider maybe something like psychology?
Yeah, there's a high degree of psychology involved in what we're doing. And I think the more evolved customers that we have understand that. Look, anytime you're changing space, you're impacting culture. Anytime you're changing people, you're impacting culture. And you're changing people just about every day. Anytime you're changing the equipment and the furniture, the resources, you're changing culture. Well, when you're changing all three at the same time, your space, your people, and your resources, it's going to have a massive impact on your culture. And it's either an intentional impact or it's unintentional impact. And what we're trying to do is help customers be more intentional about their impact on the culture, set a target, what you're trying to accomplish, and then we can help design the space to get there.
Goodman cautions that what worked for his company and what his employees said they wanted may not work for other businesses or be what their workers want. But in his case, he says the goal was to get more workers back in the workplace, in whichever part of it they'd prefer, and to bring the elements of working from home that they liked into the office.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. As of the beginning of this month, Arizona-based Sprouts Farmers Market has become the official grocer of the Southeastern Conference. The company has been a sponsor of college and professional sports before, but my next guest says this is a new chapter. Alisa Gamelik is the chief marketing officer for Sprouts. She joins me to talk more about this new partnership. And Alisa, what went into the decision to sponsor the SEC?
Well, our journey actually begins almost 2 years ago when we as a brand actually decided to broker 50 female athlete NIL deals in 2022 to support the 50th anniversary of Title IX. And if you think about the connection to Sprouts, well over 50% of our customers are women of all ages. And when you think about the connectivity to Sprouts and female athletes, our mission is really to help people live and eat better. And that is probably even more so important for women in general. And so this really started in 2022. And I think we just decided to dip our toe in the water with those NIL deals. Then we became the first founding Back a Kit sponsor for Angel City in 2021 for the 22 season. And we actually just extended that deal in April 2024. And we were so amazed by the outpouring of support that we received just by sponsoring Angel City. So many of their values really align with our values as a company in supporting women, in supporting female athletes. And as you know, for them, supporting, you know, women as business owners as well. And so we really sort of have taken that sort of to the next level as we think about the SEC with the sort of the fall of the Pac-12. We really decided that it would be incredibly worthwhile for us to think about partnering with the SEC because we're expanding in that part of the country. And if you marry that with our mission of advancing, you know, women both in equity and in sports, it really was kind of a match made in heaven, if you think about it.
So when you talk about, you know, sponsoring NIL deals for particular athletes or the the sponsor on the back of the jersey for the soccer team, it seems like it's a pretty big leap to go from those to the SEC, which is a big time conference, especially in sports like football and basketball. Do you expect to get the same kind of result from that as you have with the kinds of sponsorships you've done already?
Well, I think what this is about is we believe that we are going to get pretty amazing results across the board. Our connectivity, as you know, Los Angeles is one of our core markets. And so partnering with Angel City in the Los Angeles market was just a great fit because we have so many stores in the Southern California area. When we think about the SEC and what they're doing for women's sports in general, we really felt like this was going to be a great expansion for us into markets that, you know, we're expanding in. And when you think about the idea of what women's sports is between softball, basketball, gymnastics, all of those sports are getting so much more awareness now than they ever have before. We believe that there's going to be a major relevance play there for us in being connected to the SEC.
Well, so you mentioned that Sprouts is looking to and expanding into that part of the country. I'm wondering, though, if you also, when you were thinking about making this move, did it matter that the SEC does take seriously women's sports and have quality women's sports into your decision, not just from a business perspective to say, OK, we're expanding into this part of the country, it's a good conference for us, but we also like what the conference is doing and how it will represent our brand?
Oh, absolutely. No question. I mean, we had been partners with, you know, the Big 12. We had looked into that. We had been partners with the Pac-12. And through our evolution of staying involved with sports in general, we've really evolved our stance in partnering with women's sports. And there's no question that the SEC has made this a much bigger priority for their conference as well. I mean, let's be honest, the SEC is a tremendous conference for both men's and women's sports. We will be doing some participating in some of the men's media activities as well. But really, our mission and where we want to have most of our activations and stay most connected is on the women's side of supports of sports so that we can focus on that.
What kind of response did you get when you were just doing the NIL deals? And I'm curious because seems like a very specific kind of thing. Like you have particular athletes that you are working with and essentially sponsoring, as opposed to an entire conference, which has a lot of schools in it with a lot of other, you know, going down the level, a lot of then individual athletes.
Yes. Well, I think we get two sides of it. By partnering with the SEC, we get sort of the broader picture of partnering with women's athletics at a broader scale. when we partner with the NILs, what we love is we love working with these athletes. And if you follow, for instance, our Instagram or any of their Instagrams, it is amazing to see their connectivity with our brand and be able to see how they live a healthier lifestyle. I think it just sort of brings it home a little bit more. We think that this is really the inspiration part of how we inspire people to live and eat better.
Even though this deal with the SEC is now in place, does Sprouts plan to continue working with athletes here in Arizona, your home base?
Oh, absolutely. We are still partnered with Arizona State. I don't think we would ever move away from Arizona State and our connectivity there, because this is where our home base is and we've got great connectivity. In fact, I think we're going to be looking at figuring out how do we continue to expand that partnership, you know, in some more relevant ways into our community, because we just know that they've been a great partner for us as well.
So I've got to ask, because, you know, anyone who watches sports or listens to sports on the radio will hear, you know, the official name your industry of, you know, the league, the team, whatever, you know, it could be the official travel agent, the official hot dog, the official grocer in your case. Like, does that stuff legitimately matter, like to be the official grocer of the SEC as opposed to just sort of a sponsor of the conference?
You know where I think it makes a really big difference? I think it makes a really big difference when you have a brand like Sprouts and we have taken the initiative to become the official grocer of the SEC. We are not your traditional conventional grocer. Truly, we are a specialty retailer that focuses on innovative, organic, natural items. And I think what it does is I think it makes people sort of turn an ear and say, wait, Sprouts. If they hadn't heard about Sprouts before, it's going to hopefully prompt them to think about us and want to investigate and find out more about us, especially in the SEC, where our awareness is still in a growing state. And we're communicating sort of who we are as a brand as we move through our expansion plan. So I think in some cases, to be the official whatever it is for a certain conference, if everybody knows who you are, I think that's good. But in our case, because we're somewhat unexpected, we think that's part of what makes this so much more exciting.
All right. That is Alisa Gamelick, Chief Marketing Officer for Sprouts. Alisa, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Melanie Martinez spent much of her childhood working in her family business, one of Tucson's first tamale and tortilla factories, El Rapido. Her great-grandfather opened it in the 1930s, and it evolved as it was passed down through generations of her family, eventually becoming a sort of lunch counter and market hybrid. They sold lunch-to-go and tamales and tortillas made with corn ground by a big molino. Now she's written a memoir about it after that all-important molino, in which she grapples with her family's story and what happened to them after her dad sold El Rapido. I spoke with her more about the forthcoming book, beginning with why she titled it The Molino.
That was important to me because, number one, it was the most important machine all the way through, right? That the business probably never would have lasted without that. It was the thing that provided the ingredients for the two main things that they made, which is tamales and tortillas. It was a tamal and tortilla factory. Mm-hmm. So that machine was superior. It was also the machine that kind of had the most mystery to me. I didn't quite understand how it worked at first. I just knew it was really loud and really big, and it had volcanic stones inside. So that just kind of lent to the mystery of it for me. And then, you know, just thinking in terms of memoir, it was helpful for me to kind of think about what happened to our family as a process. And that's what the Molino is. It's a processing machine, right? It's a machine that grinds things and changes things. And so that's kind of the way that I was developing somewhat of a metaphor for even my dad, you know, someone who was just grinding and grinding and grinding and changing in the process. And we all kind of changed in the process.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about your relationship to the place, to this family business, to Tucson. I mean, it seems like there was a long time in which you really wanted to get out.
For sure. growing up there, being, you know, a a child working in the kitchen when it was really hot in Tucson, you know, during our summer breaks or any of our school breaks, didn't feel like a good thing to me. It felt like a thing that I really did want to kind of get out of. And not that my dad was trying to pressure us necessarily, my brother and I, to take over the business. It wasn't exactly that, although I think he might have liked that. But there was definitely this sense of my generation, my brother and I, needed to maybe find a way to move up in the world, right? So that we're not relying on the food industry for our livelihood. Mm-hmm. And because it was really hard work. Anybody who's worked in a kitchen knows how hard that work is.
Yeah.
And so we were hoping for better in many ways. And then, you know, that basically made me feel like everything that was happening in El Rápido was not as important as what was happening in the rest of the world or even the rest of the city. And, you know, it took me a long time to realize that was not necessarily the right assumption to make.
Yeah. I want to talk about the first time you wrote about this, right? Like, you've written this entire book now, but you started this like in college, taking a creative writing class, right? Writing about your experience working there.
That's correct. So I was taking creative nonfiction, was my major at the University of Arizona. And in my very last semester of school, right before I graduated, I wrote an essay about El Rápido. And I didn't really think it was that important or that, you know, important of an essay, or it wasn't even, you know, incredibly meaningful to me. It was more like an exercise. Can I describe this place that's important to my family? And right after I wrote it, you know, within a few weeks after I wrote that essay, my dad told us that he was closing. And so then suddenly that piece of writing felt like I was documenting something that was about to be gone. Mm. And it turned into a much bigger, a much more important project at that point. And really was the reason why I ended up going to graduate school and getting my degree in creative writing.
Wow.
It was really the thing that pushed me through all of that. And it took a long time to finish the story. So the first time I wrote the essay in that undergrad class was in the year 2000, and here we are, you know, 2024,
wow,
barely finishing it. So it took a long time.
That's amazing. So tell us about that, when your dad had to close it, why he had to close it. What was this like for the family?
It was very devastating, I think, for the family, and also a relief. Those two things at the same time.
Yeah.
In one way, the devastation was, this is all we knew. Like, what's going to happen to my dad? How's life going to work for him? Because this is the only thing that he really knows how to do well. And it's not like he was making very much money to begin with. And then on the other hand, it was a relief because it was just so much work. Mm. And we knew he couldn't do it forever. And the reasons why it closed were actually kind of difficult to untangle. Hmm. It was difficult conversations I had to have with my dad, even, you know, in the last few years, to really figure out what happened. And to be honest, I still don't know everything, whether or not it's true or not true. I only have some guesses and a little bit of insight as to what happened. And so I write about that in the book. But more importantly, I think instead of just the singular reasons or the things that kind of pushed it over the edge to close, mm-hmm, were part of a bigger picture of gentrification that was happening in Tucson, especially downtown Tucson in the 90s. Many, many places closed in downtown Tucson. And, you know, we had these different waves of renewal that kept on kind of pushing smaller businesses out. And it's not something that we're still not dealing with today. We're still dealing with that,
yeah,
that issue of gentrification throughout Tucson.
Yeah. So the book, I understand, has two sort of voices, right? Like yours, and you write from the point of view of the person in this mural on the outside. It's a mural of a Mexican person napping against a saguaro with a sombrero, which has become something of a divisive figure today, that idea. Why did you write some of this book from his perspective?
Well, that mural, storefront mural, is very iconic to my dad's place, but also to many other Mexican restaurants, Mexican associated businesses. It's a pretty common image. And when it was created, it was actually painted by my uncle, who's an artist, my dad's older brother. And I knew when it was being painted that it was really special, that it was important. Our family had that particular image on the receipt book. My great-grandfather had it on the receipt book that he used. And so it was an iconic image from my dad, something that they connected to family, something that helped them kind of connect to ancestry in Mexico too, which they didn't have very, very close connections to. So it's just, it's kind of all packed into just this image.
Yeah.
And of course, it's a controversial image. So when it was being painted, there was a neighbor who came and, you know, kind of criticized the image, talked to my dad about why he shouldn't use that image. Hmm. And my dad decided to just use it anyway. He wasn't really as concerned with the how other people perceived it. The thing that was more important to my dad was the symbol, what that symbol meant to him and to our family. And so it's a controversial image, and it brings up a lot of, you know, questions and concerns, and definitely makes you think about history. And it definitely made me think about where it came from.
Yeah.
So I started using that image because it's the image of a person, thinking about the voice of that person and thinking about how that voice might have something to say to me about my ancestry, about our faith in our family, about food in general, all of these ideas that have to do with like just a spirit that's speaking to me and definitely speaking to other people in my family as a valuable, important symbol.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there. That is Melanie Martinez, senior lecturer at the University of Arizona and author of the new book, The Molino, which is a memoir. Melanie, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for talking to us about this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, too.
Janet Traylor's collection of ancient apothecary and medicine bottles is kept in an old wooden ammunition box under the grand piano in her Midtown Phoenix home. Her collection came to her already completed and filled with memories. It's a gift from her late father, with whom she collected these blue and green and clear glass containers when she was a child. KJZZ contributor Robert Pala visited Traylor to learn more.
So I collect because the things that I collect spark joy. It just happens to be that a lot of things spark joy for me. So I'm not a minimalist. But I also think that we collect because it's a representation of times past, and it's intellectually interesting to see how people lived and to see the artifacts of those lives. I ended up with this great stash of bottles by being the daughter of an inveterate collector of odd items. But at that time, this was in the early 1960s, and the family entertainment for a family that had limited resources included sort of spelunking, not in caves, but in the mountains, and in particular in the abandoned mining dumps around Buena Vista. And my dad was an outdoorsman, not only an outdoorsman, but had an old Willys Army type Jeep. And we would go high above timberline and look at these old mining camps. But closer to home, only one block away from our house, was an abandoned dump. And this provided hours of cheap entertainment for our family. My dad would come home from work, you know, unlace his boots and put on another pair of boots, I suppose. And my siblings, sometimes my mom, I sometimes would go and help him. We were his little pack of archaeologists with our little spades. So during that time, my dad and the family collected dozens of these bottles. And fast forward, after his death, I ended up with his collection, which is now my collection. And most recently has been housed in a wooden ammo case. People come, they see this under my piano, they say, "Are you waiting for the apocalypse or whatever?" And I say, no, it's my dad's bottles. Okay, so here it is. And in here, I don't know how many bottles there are. Everything in this is still wrapped from the time my father put them in here. This is wrapped in a piece of newsprint dated February 4th, 1978. And inside of this, there is a bottle called Philada Dr. D. Jane's
carminative balsam. It's a skinny little bottle about 6 inches tall. And this is the first time it's seen the light of day since my dad put it in here. Here's another one. This is an early version of Milk of Magnesia. This is a patent from the U.S. Patent Office. And the date on the bottom is August 21st, 1906. There are a lot of patent medicines, and a lot of them make kind of interesting claims. We have a remedy for consumption. We have remedies for diarrhea, spelled the old-fashioned way. And separate from the patent medicines were things like Suter's Elegant Flavoring Extract. Oh, that's actually a remedy also. Suter's Elegant Flavoring Extracts, Royal Remedy Company in Dayton, Ohio. So these bottles all have their provenance. Here's one from Leadville, Colorado. There's one from Denver, Colorado. They're from large cities, small cities, Chicago. There's one from New Mexico. It's quite a range. They do not have paper labels. The labels were essentially molded into the bottle. So it's this raised lettering that's very tactile and actually quite beautiful. Many of them have a nice kind of a pearlescent look on the exterior just from being buried for many years. I think my dad kept these kinds of things because he had a fascination for ephemera. He had a fascination for how people lived. He had an aesthetic appreciation that maybe wasn't about museum pieces or art in the conventional sense, but he had an aesthetic appreciation for these items.
That was Janet Traylor talking about her collection. This piece originally ran last June. You can see photos of Traylor's bottle collection. Just go to our website, theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to this Thursday edition of The Show. Mark, we'll be back with you again tomorrow morning for the Friday News Cap. A whole lot to hit on this week, Mark. It'll be a good one, I'm sure.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.